I would like to encourage everyone to begin working with cultivating certain what are called jewels or adorning qualities. How can one incorporate certain good qualities in life, certain riches in one's own life that could enhance our view, that would support our devotion to the path of Dharma, so that that support would allow the fruitioning of our aspiration of enlightenment for the benefit of self and the others, with lesser challenges, with lesser hindrances, and with greater speed. I think if one does spend time in trying to work hard, in persevering, in acquiring these tremendously beneficial qualities in life, I think it will be helpful, because these are not just something that I have come up with, you know, as a composition, but it is something that we've learned from our teachers, observing them, receiving teachings from them, and trying to, observe and learn from their examples on how they live their life, which allows us to then bring a certain kind of a meaning of the Dharma more intimately within our own self, so that everything just doesn't remain an intellectual pursuit, an outer pursuit. So these 12 wealths that I encourage everyone to cultivate, I think the first is the wealth of Dharma, to spend time in understanding how important Dharma is, how precious Dharma is. There's nothing that is actually more precious than the Dharma. We defend samsara, particularly we try to, whenever obligations and responsibilities come up, whenever the mind feels a little bit of resistance to totally letting go of self-absorption and self-attachment, we immediately come up with kind of a sort of a natural defensiveness, and we think we have to champion samsara. So we say, okay, but you know, certain things in samsara are important, samsara has certain qualities. You know, one of the famous things we come up with and say, if there's no samsara, there would be no nirvana, or something very intelligent like that. But if one spends a little bit of time, yeah, and really thinks very carefully and uses one's own true analysis and observation, it's not very difficult to see samsara as nothing but a quagmire. And sooner or later, the more we indulge in it, we will sink in it. Also, you know, I'm not talking about abandon samsara to cultivate Dharma. I'm not talking about that. But at the same time, if one is aware of the preciousness of the Dharma, one will understand the importance of slowly decreasing, letting go, particularly of those things that are within samsara, which induces and increases self-absorption, self-attachment. Wherever there is great self-indulgence, that person will always have difficulty in having sympathy, empathy, kindness, genuine love, and the ability to let go of grasping and clinging. If one is a practitioner and one truly values the path of liberation and sees that as ultimate happiness, then it will not be difficult for that person to let go of all those distractions and understand the importance of realization and that which cannot happen until we begin to decrease samsaric neurotic patterns and treasure Dharma in our lives. So cultivating wealth of Dharma. Cultivate wealth of Dharma. Dharma, as many of you know, simply means the truth. Every single day, taking small but important steps towards gaining strengthened practice, leading to true seeing, is very important. Take small steps. Don't try everything at once. But just as you sort of gather 50 cents, a dollar, $15, $10, and you go to the bank and you religiously make deposits and so forth. In the same way, every day, gain some strengthened momentum in one's practice until you understand Dharma means seeing the truth as it is, not with the taintedness, not seeing all the illusions as real, not seeing from a neurotic emotional mind, sentimental mind. But gaining the wealth of Dharma is gaining the strength to see things as it is true, as it is truly there. Even if it is for a fleeting moment, work hard to acquire that wealth of seeing things as it is. Because when you know how things really are, letting go is so much more easier. Doing the right thing will always be so much easier. Cultivating the wealth of Dharma means taming one's own mind. Remember, one may attempt to learn, to meditate, to practice many things, but nothing is gained until one tames one's own mind. So as our teachers say, tame one's own mind and you have gained the wealth of Dharma. So, there's a, as the year unfolds, you will hear many teachings, you will read many books, you will sit in meditation, and all of these are wonderful, they're very good. But make sure that in doing all of these many different things, that you are able to treasure the wealth of Dharma. Seeing things as they are, taming one's own mind. And when that is done, you'll become wealthy with Dharma. Just as much as this first wealth is important, the second I encourage is to work with acquiring the wealth of good health. Being a practitioner, sometimes I think people neglect their health. So good health is very important. Good health is an expression of recognizing the preciousness of human existence. Know that good health comes from a serene mind and healthy habits. You may have received many teachings and know a lot about the many different philosophies of Dharma. Your belief, intellectual belief of the view, might be quite profound. But despite that knowledge, despite knowing it, if it doesn't reflect in your treasuring of your precious human existence because of bad habits, whether it is drugs, whether it is smoking, whether it is alcohol, or other things such as being angry, being very oppressive, being self-destructive, living in great depression, disappointment, not being able to trust one another, laziness, all of those negative habits are not being able to cultivate good habits that protect life, because mentally the mind loses its serenity and its calmness. That affects your body also. So good health is very important. Few things that are very important, I think, to have good health is to eat a balanced diet. Learn to really work with your breath. Breathe deeply, inhale and exhale. Learn to work with taming and training one's own breathing so that it allows the mind to have the most beautiful support of sort of calming down and resting as much as possible in its own nature. Meditate, learn to meditate. Cultivate moderation in life. Live moderately. Be cheerful. For good health, to be cheerful is very important. Even sometimes when that cheerfulness has to be a little bit forced. But, you know, like every medicine that has to be taken with some kind of discipline, cultivate cheerfulness. Maintain an interest in life. Make an effort to be kind and helpful to the others. If you want to be healthy, be helpful to the others. Especially try to be kind and helpful to the others, but be free from sort of hidden agendas and expectations. If you go out to help somebody else and yet you have a hidden agenda or you have an expectation, that help could ruin your health rather than, you know, build something positive in yourself. One of the secrets of good life is to find joy in silence and solitude. Learn to do that, especially as you grow older. Learn to be happy in silence and solitude. One of the remarkable things that you will find in our teachers, and I think which is a secret of, you know, their sort of good health, is to cultivate a childlike, you know, joyfulness in sort of being curious. You know, there's a sort of a discovery that they make of simple things. Especially great teachers, I've observed that in my teachers, is that these are enlightened minds. Yet in very simple and small things, they have this very childlike curiosity. They take an avid interest. And yet at the same time, this wonderful childlike curiosity of theirs is without any kind of, you know, unnecessary profoundness or any kind of a stickiness to it. It's just pure joy. And from that pure joy, there's simplicity, there's sort of great happiness, laughter, and I think that really stimulates good health, and, you know, it helps your system to really be healthy. So as much as possible, cultivate these good, I think, qualities to building a good and healthy life. And if you are healthy, mind is healthy, physically you are healthy, then it's a good vessel. It's a good vessel within which the view of the Dharma can manifest, I think, with lesser obstacles and hindrances. Third wealth, I think, that one must try to cultivate and learn about is the wealth of success. Now, what is success? Because, you know, when you are a spiritual person or a practitioner, very oftentimes you also live with the stereotype kind of a title of not being successful in life. So what does success actually mean? So be successful, but understand what success is. From the Dharma perspective, the wealth of success comes from the power of decisiveness. You know, being decisive. You make a decision and you remain firm and steady and patient with that decision. That is going to lead you to success. Wealth of success comes from decisiveness and having a simple outlook to things. One must learn to be steadfast, patient, and firm with one's decisions, and be victorious, successful in any action that one undertakes. And it doesn't matter whether that what you have undertaken is something very big or something very small. To have this wealth, to have the wealth of success, never begin something with a thought, what if this doesn't work? Because if one has this kind of attitude even before you begin something, then one ends up only planning. If one begins everything assuming this won't work, or you're not content with what you have begun, you do things but you do them half-heartedly, begin something and then you have, you know, other thoughts. you're fully inspired to do something in the daytime, you go to bed, you have second thoughts. What happens with all this kind of an attitude is you become only a planner. You become very good at planning things. You don't become good at carrying things to fruition. One only ends up thinking, worrying, and nothing is accomplished. Life finishes, and nothing actually good or substantially beneficial for self and others is acquired. Success is not about just becoming rich or famous, having a title, you know, or something like that. Success is seeing through to completion whatever it is that you are doing, and to be joyful in what you are doing, even if it is sweeping the floor, even if it is washing the dishes. Do it well, do it joyfully, see it to completion. Do it without an agenda. Do it because, you know, you're able to accomplish it, and find the joy of success, the wealth of success, in having that attitude in life. So success must be understood as doing your best regardless of the result, because it trains, having that attitude towards success trains our mind to be free from hope, from expectations, and the trappings of, you know, all the material things that are there. Some people are there who, you know, do simple things, but they do it with steadfast interest, see it to completion, and finds great joy in doing this. And this could be simple things like, you know, planting a tree or making a meal. And then if your attitude to big or small things remains really in this way, then you have the glow of success in your life. So the third wealth, no matter what you have undertaken, what you are doing, try to do it successfully and gather the wealth of success in life. Fourth, I think, quality that many of us as practitioners need to cultivate is to develop the wealth of courage. You know, we very oftentimes, you know, we've spoken about building confidence, being brave, cultivating courage, and so forth. So what is courage? You know, there are many different ways to approach the topic of courage and to try and see what it is. But courage, one way of looking at courage is being, you know, able to be without all the different kinds of fears that we have. For example, being afraid of not being successful. Look at the fear first. To be brave, to be courageous, first look at the attitude that one has. Does one have the attitude of being afraid of not being successful? You haven't even started something, but you're just afraid of not being successful. Being afraid of committing, being afraid of making mistakes, being afraid of making a fresh start or beginning fresh. Every time you're told to start again. Let's take Yongontro for example. And if a teacher says, why don't you start from the beginning? People almost think that that's a sign of a failure. You don't see it as, you know, maturing more beautifully, because you're able to make a fresh start. But that fresh doesn't have to mean you failed at something before. So then that's about the attitude. So observe and see the attitude that one has, that is afraid of making a fresh beginning. Then another sign of lack of courage is being afraid to letting the past be. You know, sort of just chasing after the, keep thinking about the past, too afraid to let the past be. Being afraid to doing anything, being afraid of breaking free from habitual patterns. You know, that's another tendency that really builds lacking in courage. For one to truly be able to manifest the view of the Dharma, how will you do that if one is not courageous enough to break free from habitual patterns and to keep persevering in working towards decreasing of you know, habitual tendencies and so forth? So these negative tendencies, when they are let be, when you let go of these attitudes, you're freed of these attitudes, that is then gaining the wealth of courage. Because when people lack courage, people lack happiness. Even before beginning something, if you started off with, will I succeed? Will I win? What will others think? Should I? Shouldn't I? What if this happens? What if that happens? Then there are just too many namtoks. There are too many discursive hesitations and doubts, which truly is going to lead a person to lack completely in courage. And when that courage is missing, when the wealth of courage is missing in life, transformation and transition from negativities to positive qualities is going to be very, very difficult. From samsara to nirvana, that transition will become very, very difficult, because the timidity of your own attitude will always be a great obstacle. Now these days, this is more enhanced, where especially the younger generation, I think everyone, but especially the younger generation, where, you know, there's an unfortunate trait where people have become very careless about looking into themselves, examining oneself from within, and beginning to know yourself better, and take that as the reference of trying to build a better person, trying to work with oneself. Instead of doing this, one has begun to place tremendous importance in presenting an image of oneself based on the expectations of the others and the opinions of the others. Peer pressure or friends' opinion or whatever is in vogue in the world today, you know, sort of just an imitation, and trying to imitate has become so important. When one relies on the outer's opinion, the opinion of the outer, not really knowing oneself, then you live in great confusion. Where that confusion becomes more and more, you really do not know your own self. There's a sort of a crisis in identity. And when you don't know your own self, what is it that you're going to work with? For example, when you're a practitioner and you're trying to work with taming the mind, transformation of the self, and if you're not, and if you don't know what it is that you're working with, then everything becomes very pretentious. And so that's why, you know, we behave in certain ways in front of the teacher or in a Sangha environment, and then we relax and revert back to something else in another environment. And so when they, you know, when there's that confusion that continuously persists, then you don't have the strong basis and the awareness of the basis with which you're working. So therefore it's very important to continually know how to work with one's own self. When you work with one's own self, you have greater confidence, you have greater sort of ability to go beyond doubts and hesitations. Sort of certainty arises, and that's the good basis for building courage in one's own self. So courage and confidence is very important, and for that, to be more introspective, to know yourself better, to be able to really look into one's own self. Silence, especially silence, is very important, to look into one's own self and to know what it is that your, you know, good qualities are and enhance them. To look at what are those negativities that you're struggling with, and to reduce them, to decrease them, to work with the antidotes. Those are things that are very important, and that's a mark of courage in one's own life. Fifth wealth that I'm going to talk about is wealth of friendship. Having a caring attitude, having a sense of belonging, having a flexible attitude that adjusts to all situations easily. Someone who encourages each other on the path of virtue are the signs of friendship, good friends. Particularly what comes to my mind is a quote from the Buddha's teachings in the sutra where he says, "An insincere and a neurotic friend is to be feared more than a wild beast. A wild beast may wound your body, but an evil friend will wound your mind." And that's very, very true. Sangha consists of many good friends. And you have to learn to be a good friend and learn to have good friends. Friendship requires the friend to be responsible in showing the path to greater sanity, basic awareness, basic sanity. There are people who among friends project their own insecurities and their own neuroses. And I think that's really very, very dangerous. It's very, very harmful. One should keep away from such friends at a time where your mind is not so strong in the view and the actions being, you know, completely inseparable. There will come a day when you will have enough confidence of the view that you may be in the midst of all kinds of, you know, people or in different kinds of environment, and yet it won't be strong enough to influence your mind. But until you are sort of in a fragile state where you get easily influenced, you have to be very careful to avoid those situations where the environment of neurosis makes you even more neurotic. If you are a friend, you have to be able to be really careful that one never projects one's own insecurities and neuroses such that it deviates another person's mind from the path of the Dharma, from the path of the truth. Then there are people who think allowing this to happen to yourself, you know, allowing somebody else to making you more neurotic is the sign of being a good friend. And this is also not true. Letting the influence of friends lead you into retaining the worst of the human neuroses is not being a good friend. It's being foolish. So you have to be able to understand what is a good friend and acquire the wealth of friendship. One must learn to first cultivate one's own mind in such a way that you yourself are the most ideal friend. You know, how to look at friendship. You know, so we're not going to say, oh, I'm going to run away from all these friends because they're very neurotic. Before you do that, first work with yourself. You become a good friend. Do not look for a perfect friend, but instead, for be oneself, become the perfect friend, and then you will find that the world is not such a lonely place after all. So this year, work with building up friendship. Sixth is the wealth of skill. Now let me first just go through what is wealth of skill. Some are good at writing. Some people are good at arguing, that's also a skill. Some are good at music, some are good at cooking, some at cleaning. Some may have a good voice, some have good memorization skill. Some are good administrators, some can make people laugh. Some can lead well, some can be led well or follow well. Wealth of skill is knowing. What is one's skill? One must recognize one's own skill and work with that. Many people don't recognize one's own skill, and instead of trying to build whatever it is that is in you. Continue to look at the skill of the others. Have envy at the skill of the others. Try to imitate the skill of the others. And in that way, you never gain the wealth of skill. So that is, you know, when one does not know one's own skill, and one is deprived of the wealth of skill. Skill are of varied kinds, and you must learn to appreciate that. You know, in the traditional analogy, we have the thousand-armed Genrezig. You know, there's this form of Avalokiteshvara Genrezig with 1,000 arms. And I remember once Jagdishchandra Rinpoche telling me, you know, what it personifies. Of all the many different symbolisms that are there, he said, skillfulness are the 1,000 arms of Genrezig. If you look at that figure, you know, the compassion of Avalokiteshvara, of Genrezig, manifests in the manifold 1,000 arms. And each arm is part of that one single body of the Bodhisattva. And if you look at the iconography or the pictures, you will find that all of the hands, the 1,000 arms, are exactly the same. So, you know, none are bigger or smaller, greater importance or lesser importance. So therefore, wealth of skill comes when you know whatever it is that you are able to do, when you do that well, when you do it with genuine happiness and joyfulness, then it truly becomes a source of goodness to others and towards yourself. Even the most simple, trivial of the skills can be a great wealth. One must learn to take joy in whatever smaller and big things one can do well, because that is this wealth of skill. And instead of discovering that and treasuring that, if you spend more time in looking at somebody else's skill and then wanting to do that, you know, oh, you see a wonderful umze and you think, oh, I'd like to do an umze. You know, you cook well, but you know, you think, oh, anyone can cook well, but I'd like to become an umze. And unfortunately, you don't have the voice, or you don't know the liturgy, or you've never done that. So those are, you know, simple things that does happen very often times. I've noticed that, where what you could best contribute in is not treasured, and you lose so much time in trying to simply gain the skill of another person. So don't do that. This year, spend time in acquiring the wealth of skill, your own skill. Discover that. Make that beautiful. Make that a source of generosity to the others. Make that a source of happiness to yourself. Be joyful in that and give to the others. In the same way, work hard in acquiring the 7th wealth, the wealth of laughter. You know, I was reading a quote about laughter where the Buddha said, there's a quote where he says, at the height of laughter, the universe is flung into a kaleidoscope of new possibilities. So I think lot of wisdom in that. Where does it say that where you have become a Dhamma practitioner, you have to become so serious in your own profoundness that you lose laughter in life? Then you become so serious, sad and serious, without any laughter. You know, maybe in the future we will have bodhisattvas who are so profoundly serious that they have forgotten happiness and laughter. And you get pictures of kind of, you know, bodhisattvas, very profound, very serious. I think that's a kind of contradiction to what selflessness is, what enlightenment is, what awakeness is. So it's very important that you don't get lost in the hypocrisies of all the make-beliefs that we have, you know, of all that what we have assumed to be aspects of mature realization and understanding of the Dharma. But recognize that the more you understand the Dharma, the lighter your heart will be, the less self, you know, grasping, the tightness and the tension will be. And so cultivate laughter in your life, a full, sincere laughter each day, if possible, is very important. Laughter rests always on a mind that has the courage to have some sense of humor about oneself. Taking oneself too seriously, you know, constantly preoccupied by gauging oneself upon the opinions of the others or about yourself, you know, opinions about your own self, being overly ambitious, particularly in being enlightened. Yeah. These are sure reasons why you will lose laughter in life. And then you become very uptight. I've never heard about an uptight bodhisattva or an uptight selfless Buddha. So recognize that. Develop, cultivate loosening up of self-importance. When you really look at Dharma and the meaning the teachings present, you will find, you know, why do you hold on to that tension? There's nothing to hold on to. And you begin to actually see how foolishly we make things so very serious. Seriously good. Seriously meditating. Seriously realizing. Seriously listening, you know, all of those seriously doing things. Why do we do them? Whom are we trying to show the seriousness to? You know, if one really is understanding the Dharma, one will find a lot more of the loosening of that tension that comes with the self-importance. A little bit of humor. In one's own self, humor about the seriousness that brings attachment, that brings anger, humor about the plannings that we do of the future that might never come, you know, all those different many things that we do, that's really very, you know, laughable, it's very humorous. Those are good references to build a good hearty laughter in your own life. And in that laughter, if you can rest a bit, you might find that this might do much better in enhancing your understanding of the practice than any other kind of pretentiousness that we build in our life. Another thing that the Buddha said that comes to my mind is, you know, the Buddha said in one of the sutras, when you realize how perfect everything actually is, you will tilt your head back and laugh at the sky. So keep that in mind. To have laughter, you will need to have the ability to be without criticism. Enjoy simplicity, be beyond competitiveness, keep your mind vast and flexible, and learn to love others and get along with others. Learn to see humor in how seriously we take things and how we revel in complications. You know, especially complications. In sanghas, complications about titles and roles that we play. So when you become very serious about, oh, being a teacher, serious about, you know, being a good meditator, serious about being a chopin, or serious about being, you know, whatever it is, the titles, then learn to really laugh at yourself. And in that laughter, let go. In that laughter, really relax and let go. And you will find that to be tremendously a powerful experience in your practice, in your meditation. Eighth wealth that we could work with in acquiring is the wealth of contentment. We often tend to forget that happiness doesn't come as a result of getting something which we don't have, but rather that happiness comes from recognizing and appreciating what we already have. How many times do we spend really being happy and grateful for all the things that we really have? Versus how much more do we think we need to have before we actually have happiness? So therefore, one must recognize and take time to appreciate what we already have and to find contentment in that. One must have the wealth of contentment which comes from truly being grateful for all the things that we already have, for all the people in our lives, for all the moments that we have, that we are able to live life, which so many don't enjoy. So many people, so many beings do not have in their life. If you are able to develop a sense of awareness of how many people, how many beings actually suffer tremendously, one would probably be able to have much more contentment in one's own life. Because when one doesn't appreciate what one has, and with dissatisfaction constantly looks outward, such a person loses all peacefulness and happiness in one's own life. Our great teachers have always said, the richest person is a content person. Contentment cannot come to one who is always, you know, gauging oneself against others or depending upon outer things to make oneself a better person. Rather, you know, contentment comes from knowing here and now who one is, to becoming someone who is able to generate unparalleled benefit for self and others. Whoever you are, wherever you are, this moment is actually the best person and the moment from where an inexhaustible amount of goodness can come forth to the others. What hinders that? What usually hinders that is an extraordinarily brilliant idea that we have of doing something more. Something like someone else, a great bodhisattva. You know, we suddenly think, oh, I should become like Shantideva. You know, and that kind of a fantastic plan or a fantastic idea that we have often diminishes the actual potential that you have, which could be, you know, not as great as any great enlightened being's compassion or goodness. But your dog could have a happier, you know, moment in life. Your family members could enjoy you more. You yourself could be genuinely joyful for that moment. And being able to find the wisdom and the goodness in that is to find the wealth of contentment. Where you are content, you will be able to find it to be the best basis from where all goodness, generosity, and compassion and kindness can come for the others. Where there is contentment, such a person is a joyful person. He or she is a person where everyone is happy to be with, is inspiring to the others, and truly you are able to become more available for the others. Where there is no contentment, you're preoccupied to acquire something for yourself. And then when that preoccupation is so big in your life, where do you have the time to think about the others? So build wealth of contentment. This is the eighth. The ninth is the wealth of humility and dignity. Among the Tibetans, there is a kind of a saying that we have, you know, and I read this somewhere also, is that some Tibetans often say somebody, a person who thinks he is better than the others, knows more than the others, believes himself to be, you know, above the others, because he's more wiser or capable or learned or whatever it is said to be like a person who is sitting on the highest peak of a very high mountain. And, you know, what's at the peak of a highest mountain? It's very cold there. It's very hard. It's very lonely. And nothing grows there. But if a person puts himself in a lower position, cultivates humility, then such a person is said to be like the one who enjoys living on the fertile plains, fertile land. Humility is a wonderful quality that must be cultivated, particularly by practitioners. I think without intending to, but for whatever many different reasons, all of us experience, there's tremendous arrogance, patronizing arrogance, particularly among people who are spiritual practitioners. And therefore, cultivating the wealth of humility is very important. How is one to develop humility? Humility comes with learning to rejoice in the happiness of the others, letting go of one's own ego, appreciating others, developing a wider and a more flexible perspective of life. Humility can arise only in a person who is confident and understands dignity and self-respect. You know, humility is very difficult for somebody who lacks the confidence of working with one's own self. The more learned, the better a practitioner, the more you learn about Dharma, if you really are able to recognize what the Dharma is about, you will always find that that person becomes more simple and more humble. Someone in whom the distance between the view and the actual emulation of the view in one's daily life is, you know, distant, and if there's a gap between the view and the action, you will always find that the person's learnedness does not necessarily lead to the confidence of the view. And because of that gap, you will find insecurity in the person. So you'll always have to be, you know, sort of present yourself, enforce yourself over the others. That's ego. And so if you look at our great masters, you will find that the more learned, the more realized they are, the more humble they are, the more, you know, in their nature, there is an immense humility, because they are able to have a much more wider perspective of things as they are. It's not always self-oriented. And because of that, you know, they are able to, that humility allows them to really work with the others, work for the others in a much better way. So it's very important that one allows the sense of, you know, ego grasping to decrease it, let go of it, and allow the wealth of humility in one's own life. As much as humility is important, I think dignity is also very, very important. So humility and dignity, both of them go together. Now, what is dignity here? What I mean by dignity is much more the dignity of mind. Dignity means not being self-absorbed. Dignity can only arise in a person who recognizes and trusts basic good nature. True honor, is able to be loyal, you know, that cultivates a certain nobleness, or we could even say an elevation of mind that consists of high sense of right, what is the right thing to do. Someone who is truthful and someone who sort of abhors unkind and evil action. Dignity, someone who has dignity opposes meanness, you know, sort of mean intention or the wish to hurt somebody else. So someone who is opposed to meanness and develops gentleness in one's attitude and conduct is a person who cultivates dignity of mind. All vices are incompatible with dignity. Someone who injures others or finds one's gain and happiness in the injury of the other, someone who is linear in thought, someone whose linear thought and approach to life makes one so self-oriented, self-indulgent, such a person has no dignity at all. Where that humility and quality of dignity is absent in a person, you know, it'll be very difficult to come out of self and self-absorption, to have the time and the availability to benefit others. Because eventually, as practitioners, when you are meditating, when you're practicing, all these things that you are doing, when you devote your whole life to Dharma, outcome of it, the result of it, is to be of benefit to the others. Ultimately, it's about being truly compassionate, to be able to really generate so much goodness that you're able to share with all the others. What other purpose could there be to enlightenment other than to be of benefit to the others? Now, how will that be ever possible when the ego and the trappings of the ego are so strong that you really can't think beyond the ego itself? So, therefore, to burst the ego, the antidote is humility. But at the same time, in that humility, one must have the dignity. One must have the grace, the dignity of being able to have confidence as the reference within one's own self, to be free from all negativities, and to be able to really elevate in one's own self, who holds the treasury of Dharma, who is able to, in their own lives, in one's own lives. So cultivate the wealth, human, work with cultivating the 10th wealth, wealth of kindness. When we talk about what is cultivating the wealth of kindness, in Hindi, word, there is, you know, one word called swarth. Swarth in Hindi often comes with the word swa and arth. Now, swa means oneself, and arth generally translates as meaning, but what it really means is constantly fulfilling the demands of the self. You know, in English we simply call it selfishness. But spend a little bit of time working with the word swa and arth. You know, whatever you do, whatever you say, whatever you think, if it's constantly being, you know, sort of followed by, how, what can that do to me? How can I fulfill me? What I want? How can I change whatever is happening so that I can benefit from it? If that's the total preoccupation, such a person will never have kindness. To develop the wealth of kindness, you will have to change this attitude to its opposite. Being kind is to think about others. It is said in the teachings, one is poorer than the poorest when everything you do is solely to accomplish something for oneself alone. Such a person knows no joy nor any peace in one's own mind. Think about that. If your entire life is directed towards finding something for yourself, then you are depriving yourself of the wealth of kindness. Where there is no kindness, then there is no meaning to any aspect of Dharma that we are practicing. So if you are meditating, if you are in retreat, if you are practicing, if you're celebrating New Year as a practitioner, if you're supplicating, if you're doing your different kinds of rituals and practices, make sure that each one of them is done to cultivating wealth of kindness. Because if there is kindness, you have Dharma, you have every view correctly, you know, inculcated in yourself. Where kindness is absent, everything that you are doing is being contorted to being just another mundane activity full of self-indulgence. 11th wealth is the wealth of hearing, or wealth of listening, actually. You know, hearing, traditional practice path, is always seen as the gateway to contemplation, meditating, to wisdom, to cultivating kindness, and so forth. One must learn to listen. So many of us spend so much time telling somebody something, speaking somebody, or some of us just outright showing off how much we know. But even among friends, even among Sangha members, you know, someone who can say more is often assumed to be probably more capable or more learned or whatever it is. But one may want to rethink about this. Someone who speaks too much might actually be the most neurotic and the foolish one. Learn to cultivate the wealth of listening, the wealth of hearing. Wealth of listening builds awareness. This awareness is then the right basis for any realization, for wisdom, for kindness, and all the good qualities. So acquire the wealth of listening by first learning to listen to the others. Listen to your family. Listen to your loved ones. Listen to the animals. Listen to the changes of nature. Listen to the environment. Listen to the co-workers. Listen to the person sitting next to you. Most importantly, learn to listen to your basic nature. How much time do you spend listening to the very inherent primordial nature? Be able to work with the acquiring, with the building of the wealth of listening. And then the 12th, which I think can simply be called wealth of renunciation. In reading the sutra, the Buddha again says, let go of self and you let go of everything. Now, when we forget this, we try to let go of many things, but we never let go of the self. And so when that happens, then renunciation is never really rightly understood. For us Dharma practitioners, the whole path is the path of cessation, path of renunciation. And in order to be able to cultivate that, one must have a thorough and a correct understanding of the wealth of renunciation. One must work to cultivating it. Renunciation is not retreating into a self-absorbed solitude. You know, I've heard many people say things like, I'd love to have, you know, be in retreat. I'd love to be able to just be with my practice, you know, to be a renunciate. But that could well be simply retreating into self-absorption. So rather, renunciation is breaking the walls that we have built to divide what is ours, what is self, and what is the others. So therefore, cultivate what the Buddha said. Let go of self and you let go of everything. When such a renunciation, wealth of renunciation is cultivated, then that renunciation, that kind of a renunciation, frees us in every way. And there remains nothing but an expansive availability for others. So take some time to think about these 12. If possible, try to, you know, make more, add on to this. What are the different kinds of simple wealth that are there around us, within us, that we need to cultivate, that we need to bring as changes into our lives, which would make this life joyful, a source of happiness to self and others, and also contribute greatly in enhancing our understanding and realization of all the teachings, of all the practices that we do. Are we not ultimately someone who is fortunate in having received so many teachings, the wheel of absolute profound Dharma, but at the same time living very much in a relative world? We have no choice but to find the balance between the relative and the absolute. Whenever we forget chesam, whenever we forget the need to balance both of these, then perhaps what we end up is damaging one or the other. Sometimes the relative world is what we neglect. We neglect the very fundamental responsibilities that we have towards ourselves and to all sentient beings. We forget to cultivating good qualities that could, you know, really bring the view into a blossomed attitude and conduct action in our life. And, you know, sometimes the other extreme of living only in a profound intellectual realm. And then, you know, it is very sad that if all that we end up with, having met with the Dharma, is profound intellectual ideas that doesn't do good for anyone, doesn't do good for self or to the others. So can there be a possibility for us all to wake up to the fact that we are somebody who must, in one's own life, bring together and enhance this profound view of the Dharma in the form of all the teachings that we have received and we continue to receive, and at the same time, you know, gather all these jewels of good qualities, of sensible qualities in our life, such that the adorning jewels makes more beautiful this vessel within which the profound view can manifest as enlightened mind. So I hope that instead of many different ways in which we could spend the coming year, perhaps all of us should begin to look at finding a balance and a union of these two relative qualities and the absolute view together in our own lives. I encourage everyone to do so. Of course, beginning with my own self, I will work hard in trying to work with these, and I encourage everyone to join me in doing so. So I think working and thinking about this may be a good way to say goodbye to the old year and welcome the fresh new year. Take care of yourself, work hard with your practices, be happy in the fortunate circumstance that you all have been born in, be content and see all the goodness that you are surrounded with. And as you go ahead in this year, make it the best reference point for you to become someone who sheds and gives nothing but genuine happiness and inspiration to the others. So, all my love, and bye-bye, everyone.